Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Unite the Right rally of neo-Nazis about to take place in Washington, D.C., opposite the White House in Lafayette Park, on the one-year anniversary of the violent confrontation between white supremacists and counter-protesters in which a neo-Nazi used his car as a weapon to run down and kill Heather Heyer and injure others on the streets of Charlottesville. We'll speak with a former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance, Anthony McAleer, chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, who works with neo-Nazis who wish to leave a life of hate and violence, and discuss President Trump's belated condemnation of all types of racism, whatever that means, after he took to Twitter to attack black NFL athletes with the racist insult that they weren't smart enough to know what they were protesting about. We will get a report on the gathering of white supremacists across from the White House and a number of other counter-protests the police are keeping separate, emphasizing that this is a First Amendment event in the nation's capital. While in Charlottesville, the overwhelming police presence has resulted in no significant protests as police confiscate brass knuckles and skateboards at security checkpoints. But since Virginia is an open carry state, brandishing an assault rifle is okay. Then, with Trump sanctioning Russia, Iran, and Turkey while escalating a trade war with China, we'll examine the extent to which the president is overusing the power of the U.S. Treasury Department as a weapon, which in many ways is a more powerful tool than the Pentagon. And sometimes he does this for personal reasons, as is the case with Turkey, where Trump boasts the Turkish lira is tanking while the dollar is stronger than ever, as he puts the screws to Erdogan, who apparently reneged on a promise he made in person to Trump. Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on the national and transnational dimensions of monetary law and economics, joins us to discuss whether the capricious and injudicious use of U.S. financial power will lead to other nations finding an alternative to the dollar as a global reserve currency. Then finally, as the spat between Saudi Arabia and Canada escalates, we will speak with Thomas Juneau, a professor at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa, Canada. He joins us to discuss how the Trump administration is making it clear which side the U.S. is on as Canada makes a moral stand against human rights abuses by Saudi Arabia's pugnacious boy king, with whom Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have both political and financial ties. And joining us now, Anthony McAleer, the board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence and helping organizations grapple with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance, he served as a skinhead recruiter and the manager of a racist rock band, Odin's Law. Tony's love for his children led him on a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthony McAleer.
Hello.
Hi, Tony. Now, tell us what is happening now. I believe the main protest organized by the Aryan Resistance, or whatever they are, the loosely called white supremacists, neo-Nazis, the Unite the Right rally, is supposed to take place around 5 p.m., right? That's about 3 hours from now. So what are you seeing now in Washington, D.C.?
So at Freedom Square, which is down by the White House, there's been about 1,500 people from all different organizations, some peaceful, some not so peaceful, there to be heard. And that space has been set up as a safe space where you can come and protest and be heard with really zero chance of violence. From there, after 3 o'clock, they're going to march to Lafayette Square, where they have a permit, I think, for 1,500 people. The Unite the Right rally has, I think, a permit for 400 people. They were meeting at 2 or 2:30. We're going to meet at a subway station just outside of D.C., Vienna station, to take the train in. it looks like, from what I've heard, that the bus carrying a lot of them has been pulled over. So I'm not sure how many of them will actually end up trickling into downtown or whether they will reroute them to avoid conflict.
Do you know who pulled over the bus?
Police. I don't know which jurisdiction.
Right.
But the bus was pulled over, and I imagine they searched through everything. I mean, they've been in Charlottesville. They've been searching people looking for weapons. You know, there was weapons at Freedom Square, I saw, as well. There was clearly Antifa was there getting ready to go to Lafayette. But it'll be, I think the police in D.C. will have it on lockdown. I think it'll be very different than Charlottesville, where the police, I think, facing overwhelming numbers, just disappeared for a period of time.
Well, that was a year ago. Of course, this year they're in enormous presence. They have checkpoints around. What I mentioned in the opening, Tony, was the irony that the police in Charlottesville are confiscating brass knuckles and skateboards, but not assault rifles, because it's an open carry state, Virginia. But my understanding is that the Washington, D.C. police are confiscating any firearms, and that may be what they're doing with holding up the busload that are coming to this Unite the Right protest.
Yeah, D.C. is not an open carry city, so but even people with concealed weapons permits aren't allowed to bring them in today, and if they do, they'll be confiscated.
Right. That's unless the NRA is able to get through this law they're trying to pass nationally called the reciprocity law. So, Anthony, tell me about the counter-protesters. You mentioned you saw the Antifa people getting ready to counter-protest. There's a number of groups, I believe, Black Lives Matter among them.
Yep, absolutely. They were there as well, and a variety. I mean, there's probably 100 different organizations amongst that 1,500 in the square. And some are more direct action than others. But that square is the safe place. I know the warning is if you want to go to Lafayette Square for the next protest, you need to be okay with being in a conflict zone, so to speak. There will be confrontation. That's what's being expected. I'm going to guess that there'll be very few Unite the Right that'll get through. And I suspect that my guess is going to turn to a conflict with the police.
And do you think that the counter-protesters are going to prevent the Unite the Right protesters from getting from the subway station to Lafayette Square?
I don't think that's likely to happen. The police presence is heavy, and they got riot police from the get-go. So I don't think that they'll be prevented. I think the police will secure their ability to fulfill their permit and exercise their First Amendment rights. And I think people will get angry at the police for doing that. And, you know, I saw one thing somewhere that said, you know, this year they're wearing badges. And so I can sense that there'll be conflict one way or the other. And I think they're not going to find too many Unite the Right, because most of the major players that were there last year are disavowing this event and staying away from it. So, you know, it'll be much, much, much smaller.
Uh-huh.
And there'll be more people to counter it than there was last year. So I think the police will have a handful.
And again, I'm speaking with Anthony McAleer, who's the board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence. He also helps organizations grapple with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance, he served as a skinhead recruiter and manager of a racist rock band, Odin's Law. And Tony's love for his children led him to a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. So, Tony, can you be described as a sort of deprogrammer? Is that something you're comfortable with? Because I mean, if indeed there were enough people that showed up for the Unite the Right number 2 rally in Lafayette Square, would you go there and try and talk sense to these people? Is that your mission?
Yeah, so if you know, I've got to got to gauge my own safety, but you know, I would like to go there. The shirt I'm wearing is "Peace is the Message," and I would talk to them or try and talk to them, not to try and deprogram them. I think, you know, from what was done to people in the 70s that were in cults and stuff like that, I'm not sure if I'm comfortable with that word, but, you know, it's beginning a dialogue and treating them as a human being. Yeah, I absolutely despise their ideology and I despise their actions, but I know deep down inside, you know, it's being driven by toxic shame. And often there's, you know, the research shows, you know, just like the young men that did the Paris and Brussels attacks, there's trauma, emotional trauma in there somewhere. And if we can treat them as human beings, get them out of it and start to work on and heal the trauma, the ideology falls like a house of cards.
Well, but it's as though this all sort of emerged relatively recently. In many ways, the sort of white supremacist ideology, whether it was, you know, was receding or was sort of bubbling under the surface, it certainly came back under President Obama. And it's worth noting that it was the current president, Donald Trump, who led the Bertha movement to suggest that Obama wasn't legitimate either as an American citizen and therefore as a president. He was, you know, born in Kenya and all that stuff, that Trump led the kind of, in effect, gave people permission to be racist again. And then since the president Trump has been in office, there's been an uptick in as though the white supremacists are emboldened. And just the other day on Fox News, the Fox commentator Laura Ingraham had a commentary saying where she was essentially mainstreaming white racist scapegoating of minority immigrants, saying that they'd essentially made America unrecognizable. As far as I know, that's at least what has been reported often as the motivating factor in terms of white supremacy, is the sense that their country has been taken from them by undeserving minorities. Is that something that you agree with as a kind of uniting, emotion amongst white supremacists?
Absolutely. There's a lot of resonance that's going on and a lot of echoes. You know, but not necessarily direct links between these groups. And, you know, this narrative and the surge really started in the early 2000s when the census came out and said, you know, by 2050, the projections were that the United States whites would be a minority for the first time. And that sort of gave birth to the white genocide fear and paranoia that pervades these movements. And traditionally, white supremacist groups have surged when Democrat presidents are elected, and they don't surge when Republicans have been elected. But it's different. It's different in this case. And I think, you know, and I heard someone say, I think during the primaries and in the run up to the election, he says what I think, but I'm too afraid to say. And that's, you know, from an average, not a member of a hate group, but just someone who was interviewed on television. And I think it was always there. This is a symptom, not the source. And so I think we have to look deeper into the roots and causes of the racial strife in this country. But when it's out in the open, we have an opportunity to deal with it. It's better, I think, out in the open, as ugly and as painful as it is, than for it to be hiding and slithering in the darkness.
Right, but we've never had a president actually use racist division and dog whistles as a way to get out the vote. In essence, the explanation for him just the other day attacking black NFL players again was pretty clear that he sees this as a winning strategy for the 2018 elections to rile up his base and to make the alienated white working class supporters of his feel that they are in fact being marginalized by a undeserving majority of minorities or emerging majority of minorities. I think that's inescapable. So that's different,
absolutely.
Surely. Go ahead.
And you know, it's not just America. It's Hungary. It's Poland. It's France. It's Sweden. It's Germany. There's this populist wave. We have to get to the root of where the dissatisfaction comes from. And, you know, populism, I like to use the analogy, it's like the check engine light coming on in your car. And it's telling you that there's something systemically wrong. You know, the middle class has been put to the side, wealth inequality. You know, the root causes of the dissatisfaction isn't race. The root causes is a broken system. The globalism, I'm all for globalism, but the way it's been enacted has been inequitable and poorly implemented, and it's getting people to reject an entire system. Bernie Sanders, I think, would have beat Trump because he was not considered a globalist. And, you know, populism often asks the right question, but it never has the right answer. And I think we need to look at the deeper causes of alienation. And, you know, if you look at demographics now, white men are the only population that are decreasing in age expectancy because there's an epidemic of suicide. And think of if 50 whales wash up on your beach, the first question is, what's wrong with the ecosystem? What's going wrong that these whales want to kill themselves? And I think we have to address the racial inequality in this country, but we also have to address the massive, massive wealth inequality and the ability for everybody to have a fair shake at it, regardless of their color. And I think that needs to be looked at. Otherwise, there will always be a demagogue that can come along and whip up the mob if that dissatisfaction is always there.
Well, just in closing then, Tony, how do you drive a wedge between the demagogues and the susceptible population that's alienated? And as you, I think, pointed out very accurately and very eloquently, they essentially they have legitimate grievances. But they understand what the problem is, but they've been given the wrong diagnosis by the demagogues. In other words, for them to be somehow recognized that it's not Latinos and blacks that are responsible for their demise, but a system, and that basically blacks, whites, and Latinos essentially middle class and working people have more in common than they do that separates them, and that the reasons why their lives are going off the rails is because of the systemic problems like inequality, etc., which then you could unite against. I mean, that's something to unite around. But, of course, it's politically dangerous for the elites, particularly people like Donald Trump.
Well, and it's pretty politically dangerous to the elites on the other side, and that's why I think Bernie Sanders didn't get a fair shake. The one thing you can't do to solve this is deliver more of the same. And it's interesting, in Italy, there's the coalition government that is rejecting the globalist, the liberal world order that's been in place since the end of the war, which has worked great for a lot amount of time. But in the last, 10 or 20 years has left a lot of people wanting. And it's interesting that the left and right parties of both populists have come together to overturn the establishment elite parties. It's almost as if it doesn't matter if you're right or left. This establishment and the way it's been run for the last 30 years has got to go, and that's the sentiment. But it doesn't have to be. If there's other alternatives, you know, in Italy, you know, they voted for left-wing populists. You know, it's sad that that it's come to this. I mean, I'm a capitalist in the Adam Smith sense of the word, not what we have now. And I've always said, you know, for capitalism to work in the long run, it has to keep money in circulation. It's got to give everybody at least a taste of it so they feel it, that they're involved. Once it starts getting hoarded, you know, when we say, well, we can't have socialism, we can't have that, we need less taxes, we need to hoard the money, they think that it won't get redistributed. But, you know, when I talk to laissez-faire capitalists that say, well, you know, the market's the market, I say, well, revolution is a market force. You know, if you don't give people, you know, a chance to play and live out their dreams, they'll redistribute it for you if it goes too far. And I think capitalism has failed in keeping it everything in flow and letting everybody have a chance.
Well, indeed, a reactionary like Henry Ford understood that you had to pay your workers enough to buy the product or his product. And obviously, we are in that situation now. I thank you very much for joining us, Anthony McAleer.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthony McAleer, who's the board chair and co-founder of Life After Hate, a nonprofit working with individuals who wish to leave a life of hate and violence. And he helps organizations grapple with the causes of intolerance and racism. A former organizer for the White Aryan Resistance, he served as a skinhead recruiter and the manager of a racist rock band, Odin's Law. And Tony's love for his children led him on a spiritual journey of personal transformation that brought him to a place of compassion and forgiveness. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be looking into the extent to which Trump is using economic power through the Treasury in a capricious and injudicious way that may backfire.
Well, I'm going to tell you, fascists, you may be surprised. People in this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. You fascists, bound to lose.
Makes the world go around. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound
can make the world go round.
Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Hockett, who is a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions. A fellow of the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, and the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Hockett.
Thanks so much, Ian. Great to be with you.
Well, thank you, Robert. And in terms of the opening where I suggested that Trump is, of course, sanctioning Russia, Iran, and Turkey. He's escalating a trade war with China. Some of it seems to be personal, particularly with Turkey, where Trump boasts that the Turkish lira is tanking while the dollar is stronger than ever. And, you know, he's putting the screws to Erdogan because apparently Erdogan reneged on a promise he made in person to Trump. So Are we in a situation where this very powerful tool of the Treasury, the red notices, which arguably in many ways are more powerful as a weapon than the Pentagon has to offer, is being used capriciously and injudiciously?
Well, I think there's a danger of that, Ian. It's hard to tell at the moment whether we're sort of at a tipping point, so to speak. But there are definitely certain indications that that Trump is once again sort of like a kid who's discovered a new toy and is sort of enjoying the massive power that toy sort of confers upon him. And given his sort of penchant for personalizing what ought to be sort of national or public matters or issues, there's certainly reason to worry, even if we're not there yet. Turkey, of course, is just the latest case in point, and there are certain sort of ironies, I think, in this one in particular. I can't help but think of the old Ivan Karamazov line that one viper will devour another. One of the things that Mr. Erdogan, of course, is often criticized for is nepotism and sort of excessively personalizing the office or converting his office into a kind of cult of personality. And, of course, he's most recently been criticized for harming the Turkish economy by putting a son-in-law in charge of an important treasury department over or finance ministry department over in Turkey. I wonder where I've heard that kind of thing before. But that's one of the ironies. Another irony, of course, is that Mr. Trump is sort of trumpeting the strength of the dollar relative to the Turkish lira right now. And yet, as somebody who sort of purports to be concerned about persistent U.S. trade deficits, you would think he might be a little worried that the dollar is actually overvalued and might like to see the dollar come down in value a bit. And then a kind of a crowning irony, at least in the Turkish case, is, as we know, the New York Stock Exchange itself, or the Dow Jones Industrial Average, has actually lost a fair bit at the end of the trading day on Friday, specifically in response to the destabilizing effects that the drop in the Turkish lira is having. So there's certainly a danger that what Mr. Trump is doing right now might kind of come back to, you know, bite him on the face, so to speak.
Well, Russia's Prime Minister Medvedev last week, after the sanctions that were announced against Russia, the increased round of sanctions, suggested that America was engaging in economic warfare and hinted that Russia would respond and may even respond with other means of warfare, hinting at something quite dark and dangerous. Where do you see that situation in terms of the sanctions? Actually, is going to take a while, are they not? I mean, it's not happening right away.
Yeah, all such sanctions take a while both to implement and then actually to sort of take effect. Their effects tend to be cumulative. So they tend not to pinch right away. They tend to sort of be felt more and more over time. As for the kinds of dangers that they might raise, particularly in the form of, you know, various kinds of retaliation that we might expect, that's a fairly complex story as well, but none of it is particularly good or welcome. So the first is that, you know, even if Mr. Medvedev or other leaders of other countries that we're currently sort of engaging in a kind of economic warfare against were to respond in kind, right, in economic ways, that itself can be very dangerous and very destabilizing. We could end up, you know, you could imagine having a kind of global trading and financial order that looks distressingly similar to that kind of gradually fell into place over the course of the 1930s, you know, the interwar period, which ultimately, of course, culminated in complete global economic chaos, which, of course, did wonders for the popularity of various fascistic and ultranationalist parties in various countries and played a pretty important role, I think, in bringing on the Second World War. Leaving that happy scenario to one side, oftentimes nations or other actors who are not able to reply in kind because they don't have the kind of global financial or monetary heft that the United States has, will respond in other ways. We might think of this as being analogous to the so-called asymmetric warfare that adversary nations engage in against us when they can't meet us in the ordinary, you know, on the ordinary battlefield, so to speak, because our military sort of, you know, outclasses theirs. So there are all sorts of mischievous things that could happen then in the sort of asymmetric warfare realm where this is concerned. And there's no reason to think, right, that any nation that considers itself to be being unjustly sanctioned or singled out by the United States would restrict itself simply to, trying to answer in kind with economic mischief of their own. They might engage in other forms of mischief against us. So, again, all the more reason, I think, to be a little bit cautious before engaging even in economic warfare against a perceived adversary.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow of the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, and the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. So, obviously, on top of all of this, in terms of sanctions against Iran, Turkey, and Russia, you have tensions largely caused by Donald Trump with the EU, and also an escalating trade war with China. So when you mentioned earlier the 30s, of course, it was the Smoot-Hawley tariffs that essentially spurred the global recession, depression, was it not?
That's thought to have played a very important role. It certainly, it magnified the effects of the U.S. stock market crash of 1929 were already wreaking on the global economy. You know, a lot of people have forgotten or perhaps have never read in the history that, you know, the U.S., the stock market crash of 29 was much more than a sort of a local affair and much more than a domestic American affair. It really, really was devastating to the entire global economy, rather in the way that the 2008 crash was. Smoot-Hawley then, basically, is I think there's a pretty broad consensus that it exacerbated what was already a troubling situation. And so, you know, that's another respect, I suppose, in which you could say that the current troubles are a little bit ominously reminiscent of those of the 1930s. The current troubles seem to have commenced with a nasty financial crash that originated here, just as happened in 1929. And now this kind of drift toward sort of disorderly global economic warfare and trade, beggar thy neighbor trade policies and the like, is yet another sense in which, right, or way in which the current era is beginning to look a little bit like the 1930s. Now, that's not to say that we ought not to be rebalancing trade, and it's certainly not to say that, the sort of the current regime under which the United States constantly runs current account surplus deficits, essentially in order to provide the global currency, namely the dollar, is sustainable in the long run. All of this has to change at some point. There's a fundamental unsustainability in the current global order. But the key, I think, at the moment is that, you know, the way to change that order is to collaborate to do so, and not just to sort of, you know, pop off and, start acting unilaterally in arbitrary and capricious ways, which it's sort of beginning to look as though the current administration is doing.
Well, the United States economy is continuing to be more and more financialized. I think it's around 60%, at least that's the last statistic I had heard. So when you look at that, and then in terms of the tariffs, for example, that the U.S. has imposed on China and the EU and on Canada, on Mexico, for God's sake, two neighbors, you can see from what the Chinese are doing, the retaliation is against, soybeans. So it's almost as if the United States, in many ways, has a kind of resource-based economy in terms of agriculture, on top of which you have this financialized economy, which is all somewhat abstract, and we're using the power of that internationally, but it seems to be sort of frail. And you mentioned the possibility of you mentioned how the U.S., of course, is the global currency. Is there a possibility that by Trump pushing too hard and sort of recklessly and at a personal pique could eventually spur a backlash, and that others around the world will try and find a way around the dollar as a global reserve currency? And after all, at the end of the day, that's probably the United States' greatest asset.
Yeah, so it's a great question. You know, there's a sort of a conventional wisdom out there at the moment that we risk losing the dollar's status and all of the benefits that come with it if we continue to use the dollar as a sort of weapon, or if we continue to use the dollar system, which is essentially the global monetary system, as a weapon. I think the actual danger that we're faced with is in a way much more serious than that which is commonly cited. So the danger commonly cited is that the dollar will be replaced or displaced by some other currency like the renminbi or the euro or something of that sort, and then we would lose all of those advantages. I think that's probably an overstated claim for two reasons. One is that the dollar's role in the global economy is a mixed blessing, right? It is the reason for our ongoing trade deficits, which is not an altogether happy circumstance, right? And in that sense, it's a sort of disadvantage. But it also is in some ways advantageous, where we can borrow very, very cheaply, and so we can finance all sorts of things that we wouldn't otherwise be able to finance. So that's one problem with that claim. The other, I think, is there really is no viable alternative. The renminbi is never going to be, not in the foreseeable future, the renminbi is not going to replace the dollar as a global currency, for the simple reason that China is not willing to take on the sort of permanent trade deficits that are the corollary to that, right? The only way that the dollar is able to be the global currency is for the U.S. to run persistent deficits. And China's not willing to step into that role. But having said that, what that means is we're faced with something much more dangerous, I think, than with the dollars being replaced. And that is with the dollars not being replaced, but the dollars also not being able to continue to occupy the role that it does. In other words, we could very well see a loss of there being any de facto global currency that people can be confident will retain its value. And that would be profoundly destabilizing to the global economy as a whole. It would be a bit as though the United States no longer had the dollar, but just had, you know, Bitcoin and all sorts of other cryptocurrencies, right? If we had all sorts of different cryptocurrencies out there that were all wildly fluctuating in value relative to one another and relative to the goods and services that they would be used to purchase, we would effectively have no monetary system at all. It would be a return to something like the so-called wildcat banking era in the American economy of the early or the first half of the 19th century. That's what would happen to the global economy. We would have a kind of global wildcat currency regime if there weren't some single asset, some single currency that was operating as the de facto global currency. And the dollar's role, the dollar's occupying that role, could be threatened in the long run if we continue to use it as a sort of weapon. And so that's what really worries me more than anything else, Ian, is the dollar is being sort of displaced but not replaced. I think that's in some ways more dangerous even than the dollar's being replaced as a global currency.
Well, just in the last minute there, do you share the notion that there's something sort of doesn't make sense about the financialization of the economy and the extent to which, you know, even in the 19th century, the robber barons actually produced goods? And here we have money being made out of money and high-speed trading and all kinds of games that don't seem to be very productive, except they reward people astronomically.
Yeah, so I think there's so much to say about that we probably ought to have a separate episode devoted specifically to that, because there is so much to be said. But what I can say right now, quite briefly, is I think you've put your finger right on it. I mean, even though there was a lot of financial abuse in the late 19th century during the robber baron era, there were real goods and services that were being produced in greater and greater abundance. You know, the railroads, the steel companies, the automotive industries, all that sort of thing, right? But now we don't really have anything quite like that. What we have instead is primarily gambling on essentially speculation on price movements of various newfangled financial assets that trade on the secondary markets and in that sense are not associated with productive activity of any kind at all. And that can go on and on and on, partly because banks are able, people don't seem to realize this, to create money, right? Anytime a bank issues credit, anytime a bank makes a loan, or anytime a financial institution associated with a bank extends credit, it does so in dollar-denominated form. And so it is adding dollars to the financial economy, but all of those dollars, or at least a huge number of those dollars, are going to place bets on speculative price movements in secondary markets. That's not productive, and it's profoundly destabilizing. And indeed, it actually sucks money away from the productive sectors of the economy, i.e. from the primary markets. So we could have a great long conversation at some point on how the secondary markets have grown gargantuan in comparison to primary markets, which is the fundamental difference between now and the late 19th century.
Well, Robert Hockett, I thank you very much for joining us, and we will do a follow-up on this very topic, okay? if you don't mind.
I look much forward to it, Ian. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Hockett, who's a professor of law at Cornell Law School, whose research focuses on organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in their national and transnational dimensions, a fellow of the Century Foundation and a regular commissioned author for the New America Foundation. He also does regular consulting work for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the International Monetary Fund, Americans for Financial Reform, the Occupy Cooperative, and a number of federal and state legislators and local governments. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the deepening rift between Saudi Arabia and Canada, in which the U.S. is clearly not making a stand on human rights. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Juneau, who's a professor at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa in Canada. His research focuses mostly on the Middle East, and he also studies Canadian foreign and defense policy and international relations, and is the author of Squandered Opportunity, Neoclassical Realism, and Iranian Foreign Policy. He worked for the Canadian Department of National Defense from 2003 to 2014, chiefly as a strategic analyst covering the Middle East, and was also a policy officer and an assistant to the deputy minister. He has an article at the Washington Post, Saudi Arabia just expelled the Canadian ambassador in Riyadh. Here's why. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Juneau.
Thanks for having me.
And Thomas, it's pretty extraordinary to see Canada making a stand for human rights and being so alone, particularly with its neighbor to the south, being so silent on the matter, the Saudi Arabia, of course, it's pretty clear from the recent record since MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, has essentially become the de facto ruler. He's taken over the all the portfolios, the oil and defense, etc. He seems to be pugnacious, impetuous. He obviously has enormous amount of wealth and power, since it is an absolute monarchy. There's no checks and balances on him. And he does things impetuously without thinking through the end game. For example, blockading Qatar and starting a war in Yemen. So is this attack on Canada by Saudi Arabia yet another example of the impetuous boy king's actions?
Absolutely. This by and large, what we've been seeing in the last week is really not about Canada. I mean, there is a background of rising tension between Canada and Saudi Arabia in the last year or two that does matter, right? It does set the context for this. But mostly what we've been seeing is Saudi Arabia wanting to send a message to other democratic countries: do not criticize us on human rights or you will be penalized. And it's a broader message to the international community and to its neighbors: if you disagree with us, there will be a price. It is entirely consistent with exactly what you just described, you know, the pattern of you called it impetuousness. I would call it recklessness. Really an aggressive and ambitious and assertive foreign policy, as we've seen in the war in Yemen, the blockade of Qatar. Remember, late last year in 2017, Saudi Arabia basically took the Lebanese prime minister hostage, slapped him around, kept him for a few days, and then forced him to resign on live TV. I mean, if you think about that for just a second, that is mind-boggling. So obviously what's been going on with Canada is on a far smaller
particular scale, since Canada-Saudi relations are not very important, you know, as a whole for the international community, but for either country, this is fairly marginal. But it's really about the message Saudi wants to send.
Well, but the message that Saudi has sent since MBS came into the fore, with his father being the king, but ailing supposedly with some kind of Alzheimer's problem. Since MBS became the crown prince and the de facto ruler, he's had a charm offensive, which a lot of Western reporters and important commentators and reporters like Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, they seem to have been taken in, that this guy's a reformer. But his actions are really sort of are in cynical contrast to the lavish praise he's been getting from the West.
Well, I think when the whole debate about MBS as a reformer tends to be seen a bit too much in black and white, especially in the Western media. On some fronts, MBS really is a reformer. On the social and economic side, he is really in the process of trying, at least. It's still early days, so it's not fair to criticize him for having not done it so far. But economically and socially, he really is trying to change a lot of things in Saudi Arabia. And if anything, he's trying to change it really fast, and that raises a lot of issues of, is he overreaching at that level? Where it's important to distinguish or nuance between different types of reforms is that as much as I absolutely am convinced, I've been twice to Saudi Arabia in the last year and a half, I've seen it very clearly, that economic and social reforms are real. Politically, in terms of human rights, in terms of political rights and civil rights, not only is there no reform, there's actually movement backwards, right? So when we talk about is MBS a reformer or not, it's important to say on some levels he is and on others he's not. And this is obviously a tension, but it's not incoherent or it's not a contradiction, as some have been saying. It's really, in his own way, it's coherent in that he is telling, for example, women's rights activists, of which there's been obviously a lot of talk in the last week and a half, but other activists and society in general, yes, there will be some change, but it is going at my pace, under my leadership. It is happening because I want it so, not you guys. So he is telling women's rights activists, which he's been jailing and others sending a message to, yes, women are allowed to drive. Yes, women are getting more freedom in the labor force, for example, which is a real change that is going on. But don't get any illusions, guys. I am not democratizing further. And if anything else happens, it is because I want it, not because of your pressure.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Juneau, who's a professor at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa, Canada. His research focuses mostly on the Middle East. He also studies Canadian foreign and defense policy and international relations and is the author of Squandered Opportunity, Neoclassical Realism and Iranian Foreign Policy. He worked for the Canadian Department of National Defense from 2003 to 2014, chiefly as a strategic analyst covering the Middle East, and was also a policy officer and an assistant to the deputy minister. And he has an article at the Washington Post, Saudi Arabia just expelled the Canadian ambassador in Riyadh. Here's why. But the one thing that MBS is not talking about, and nobody seems to be talking about, is that this is a feudal country with an absolute power in the kingdom itself. He is answerable to no one. He's been able to kind of arrest a bunch of people within the own Al Saud family, these many, many princes who are the beneficiaries of oil, which sort of trickles down from them to the rest of the people. And, you know, he's been buying a Michelangelo for $500 million, chateaus in France for equal amounts of money. So he's, if anything, is being more grotesque in displays of extraordinary wealth while his country, the young people, are restive. There's, I think, one-third of the country lives in poverty, for God's sake. So isn't that something that should be talked about along with the fact that he is, in quotes, a reformer?
You're absolutely correct. The Saudi Arabia, there's multiple important elements that you just touched on. One of them is the unprecedented consolidation of power in his own hands. You know, since the 1950s, 60s, 70s, the system in Saudi Arabia really evolved where power was fairly diffuse within the very large royal family. So even though the king was you know, primus inter pares, he was the most powerful in the country, he still could not make decisions on his own. He had to consult other power centers within the family, half-brothers, cousins, and so on, as well as other, you know, the clergy and business elite and so on. In the last 3 years, what we've seen, 3.5 years, is really an unprecedented consolidation of power in MBS's hands. So in that sense, that goes back to the answer to the previous question, that even though social and economic reforms are real, political reform is not only not real, it's moving backwards. There's not only at the level of civil society arrests, but at the level of the unprecedented consolidation of power in MBS's hands and those of his closest advisors. This in many ways is worrying, because one of the many implications of how Saudi Arabia functioned in the past was that because decisions had to be consulted, they were kind of diluted, and then sometimes decisions were the lowest common denominator, which led to a very cautious foreign policy. Now, power is consolidated in one man's hands, and this man has shown that he is, as you said, impetuous, very aggressive. There are very few checks and balances on him. Even though Saudi Arabia is not and was not democratic before, there were checks and balances on the king. Not anymore. So just to broaden that point, that really opens things wide for MBS to make reckless decisions on the foreign policy front, see Yemen, Qatar, now Canada, but also domestically, to link this with the second part of your question. Saudi Arabia is a country that has obviously tremendous oil wealth, but also suffers from extraordinary inequality socially and economically, not only with the royal family being you know, an upper caste, but other members of society, high-level civil servants, high-level businessmen, but not in terms of foreign laborers, but also in many rural parts of Saudi Arabia. This is a country that has, as you said, extensive pockets of poverty. And for that to change over the years, for the mass of Saudis to really benefit from oil wealth, there's a need for massive economic reforms and redistribution and so on. Maybe that's something that MBS wants to do, but how he'll actually do it remains unclear for now.
Well, clearly, he doesn't think things through in terms of an end game. There's no end game in Yemen. And just the other day, the Saudis bombed a busload of children. The situation with Qatar is not going anywhere. It's essentially because the Saudi royals desperately want to shut down Al Jazeera because they don't want any other form of political Islam to take hold in the Middle East. That's how they've, in a sense, financed the reversal of political Islam in Egypt through their support of General Sisi. They're also digging a canal now across the border with Qatar, and MBS, along with the Israelis, are rattling, trying to chin up a confrontation with Iran, which is a real possibility. And, you know, for the longest time, a precondition for dealing in the Arab world was with Israel was that you had to deal with the Palestinian issue before we can have any kind of discussions. Well, now that's out the window. The Palestinians essentially been hung out to dry by the Saudis because of their obsession with Iran.
Oh, you're correct. There's a lot of criticism, especially outside of Saudi Arabia, that these major decisions by MBS, as you said, have not been seriously thought through. I mean, foreign policy, and this is a cliche to say that, but it's true, it's complicated. You need to seriously think things through, weigh different options, assess the costs and benefits, and so on. The easy example to show that is the war in Yemen. It's been 3.5 years now. It is absolutely devastating for Yemen. By all accounts, MBS thought that this would be over in a matter of weeks. And it's been 3.5 years now with absolutely no end in sight. And if you take this just a step beyond, in the longer term, this is self-defeating. In the longer term, this is counterproductive for Saudi Arabia. In the case of the dispute with Canada right now, in narrow terms, the cost to Saudi Arabia and the cost to Canada is very low in the sense that our bilateral relations are small. So whatever business opportunities will be lost in the next few years will do extremely marginal damage to our economy here in Canada, but also to the Saudi one. That being said, we were talking over the last few minutes a lot about MBS's attempts to reform the Saudi economy. He wants to diversify the Saudi economy away from oil. He wants to attract foreign trade and investment. One of the preconditions for that is to brand, and this is really a branding exercise, of Saudi Arabia as a stable and attractive place for foreign trade and investment. For that, there's a level of predictability that needs to be necessary. All of these actions that he's taking against Canada, all of these impetuous things that he's doing against Qatar and others, are having the exact direct effect, right, of actually showing that, no, there are no rules in Saudi Arabia. Things are not stable. We cannot guarantee that you will be protected in that sense. So the point about Canada is really marginal. It's the bigger picture element here that matters.
Well, just in closing, though, the one thing that probably will work is that he's intimidating other Western countries not to speak out against human rights abuses in Saudi Arabia as the Canadians do, right? That he may succeed on that, unfortunately, particularly because our president has, and along with Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, have both political and financial ties with the kingdom.
What Saudi Arabia clearly is trying to do, to send a clear message to Western countries: you criticize us on human rights, there will be a price to pay. I would unfortunately not be surprised that in the next months and years there's a bit less criticism of Saudi Arabia on human rights, but I don't think there will be none. I mean, just today and yesterday, the Europeans have been quietly, steadily reverting back to more gently, but still criticizing Saudi Arabia on human rights. But I think the counter-argument to that is, you know, suppose that you are at the head of a German business right now, and you know that Germany has been critical of human rights in Saudi Arabia over the past, that there actually was a similar, similar dispute between Germany and Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. You're a German business. You're thinking about investing in Saudi Arabia. I'm not saying that tomorrow morning you'll decide not to do it because of what's been going on for the last week, but you certainly will be just a bit more reluctant, right? That's only rational. So this, in this sense, is counterproductive for Saudi Arabia.
Well, Thomas Juneau, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Juneau, who's a professor at the Graduate School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Ottawa in Canada. His research focuses mostly on the Middle East, and he has also studied Canadian foreign and defense policy and international relations, and is the author of Squandered Opportunity, Neoclassical Realism in Iranian Foreign Policy. And he worked for the Canadian Department of National Defense from 2003 to 2014, chiefly as a strategic analyst covering the Middle East, and was also a policy officer and an assistant to the Deputy Minister. And he has an article at the Washington Post: Saudi Arabia just expelled the Canadian ambassador to Riyadh. Here's why. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Marks. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.